Today's sermon is going to be risky business for me because I'm going to deal with a book, and I think it may be tied to the fact that this would have been Molly's and my tomorrow 67th anniversary. But I'm going to talk about this book. It's the first book in the Megalot. It's called the Festival Scroll. In the English Bibles, it is put in with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes because they were all supposed to be written by Solomon, which a lot of scholars on this particular book do not think it is. It's called the Song of Songs. You've heard of the Lord of Lords, okay? That means he's the greatest Lord, right? The King of Kings, that's the greatest king. The Holy of Holies, that's the most holy place. When the Hebrew says that, when people say that, it's like this. But it's the Song of Songs, means it's the greatest of all the songs that were written. And these are written to be sung, okay? And this book is called the Song of Songs. In the Latin, it's called the Canticum, Canticonon, and that's how they say it. In Greek, it's called Iasmatonen. And so it's the song, each one in every language here, it meant the Song of Songs, the greatest of the songs. That's the greatest one. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, it's coming after Job. So here's the Hebrew Bible in the writing section. You know that there were three sections. Jesus talked about that in the book of Luke, chapter 24. I believe it's in verse 44. He says that the whole Old Testament, what we call Old Testament, it's the Hebrew Bible. And the whole part of these scriptures, he says, in the law and the prophets and the writings and the Psalms. He calls it the Psalm section. The reason they call it the Psalm section, it begins with Psalms. Psalms, Proverbs, Job. Song of Songs, there it is. Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. Now, those five books, okay, here they are, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, and Esther. Those five books are called the Megalot, that is the festival scroll. So the Song of Songs was always read at Passover time. We don't read it at Passover time. Most churches don't read that at Passover time. I think the Jews still do. But the only way the rabbis accepted that book was because they said it's an allegory. It's just talking about how God loved Israel so much. This is God's love for Israel. In the Christian era, the Christians said, they hardly ever read it. They didn't read it out loud. They wouldn't read it out loud because it's too blunt. It's too frank. It's too, romantic and sexually romantic. They wouldn't read it out loud. So they looked at it as the love between Christ and the church. The Jews said it's the love between Yahweh and Israel, okay? So, as I said, in English Bibles, it's lumped in with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and then because they think Solomon wrote it. It is a unique composition. There's nothing close to it as an analogy or any other place in the Bible. And there's nothing close to this. It is a collection of love songs to be sung and a celebration of erotic love between man and woman. It resembles the Psalms, and only in that both are collections of poems. That, you know, the Psalms are many poems, Hebrew poetry, that were sung, and they often sung in services and things like that. And the Song of Songs in your Bible is some of the most beautiful poetry in all the Bible. It's difficult. The reason that it's difficult to read and understand is because there are changes of speakers. This person speaks, then that person. Who is speaking now? Is it her? Is it him? Who's speaking? Sometimes it's a woman, and sometimes she's talking to her beloved directly, and sometimes she's talking to what this fiction, this group called the Daughters of Jerusalem. Oh, Daughters of Jerusalem. Okay. So the language of the Song of Songs is unique in the Hebrew Bible. It's unique. This book, the Song of Songs, is full of rare words. That's why sometimes it's difficult for translators to translate a rare word. Never saw this word before. What does that mean? Where can we find it? Including foreign words, and several Aramaic words. So one scholar suggests that the language of a Song of Songs represents a dialect. Even the casual reader is impressed by the striking quality of the language, which is sensitive, sometimes bold, sometimes subtle, and sensuous, and powerful. Some people have seen this as poetry. Some people see it as disorderly. It's disorderly. It's very simple. It's naive. Yet there's a freshness and charm to it. Others view the book as a formal lyric poetry. One scholar sees it both as two kinds of poetry in the book. The book is not a unified book, okay? The Book of Song of Songs, not a unified book. It is a collection of songs. The number of which, how many songs are there collected? I mean, some say there are a few, maybe 6, 7. Others say there's as many as 30 different songs inside that book. It's in your Bible. Yeah, it's in your Bible. The various geographical areas are mentioned in this book. Geographical. For instance, some cities up north, like it'll mention Damascus, Lebanon, Carmel, Tisra, and also down south, Jerusalem and En-Gedi. En-Gedi talks about that. The songs vary considerably in structure and in content. Speeches by each of the lovers to the other. That's what you'll find. Speeches. Speeches by the girl to the daughters of Jerusalem. And sometimes there are speeches where there are replies. And sometimes there are speeches who have nobody directed to. It could be like a dream narrative. She could be dreaming something and talking and and so on. A dream narrative, and sometimes it's a poem about Solomon. It's a passionate one person for one person, one man for one woman, and that's kind of funny that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I mean, if you read the Song of Songs, it's about, one man, one woman. Some passages praise the physical appearance of the loved one. She praises the man, his strength and his strong and this, and he praises her. It's a man commenting on almost every part of the woman's body. Others are general observations on love, its power, its sweetness, its pain. Is love pain? It can be. If it's a love song, the love song is a, if it's in the love song genre, you know, we've got the group of places, it's a love song, and it's clear that there are several subtypes within this genre, subtypes. Besides the love songs, there has been seen as interpreted as a celebration of marriage. Now, there's a passage here from the Song of Songs in chapter 3. That looks like a celebration. You're getting ready for a marriage. Okay. We're gonna be celebrating a major marriage. Okay, so here it is. Chapter 3. I'm gonna read it to you from the New American Standard Version. Pretty much the New American Standard Version has a very good translation of this, and they're trying to make it definitely exact Hebrew and being very careful. I only found one so far. I found one area where they just inserted something that's just not in there. I'll show it to you later. Here we are, Song of Songs, chapter 3, verses 6 through 11. It's like a celebration of marriage. Here it is. What is this coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke? Perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, these spices that are very, very fragrantly enjoyable, with all the scented powders of the merchant. Here it comes. This is the smoke. This smoke is like, oh, wonderful. All these scented powders, you know, all, powders. I don't mean powder. Powders of the merchant. Behold, it is the traveling couch of Solomon. That's a couch traveling. 60 mighty men around it, of the mighty men of Israel. Here comes this couch. It's coming up. There's smoke, there's powders in it, and it smells delicious, smells wonderful. And all of them, all of these men, all of them are wielders of the sword, great fighters, great expert in war. Each man has his sword at his side. Oh, here they come, a crack corps of soldiers guarding against the terrors of the night. King Solomon has made for himself a sedan chair from the lumber of Lebanon. See, it mentions Lebanon now. That's north of Israel. He made its posts of silver. Its back, the posts of the couch are silver. Its back is gold, and its seat is purple fabric. You know, that famous purple fabric with its interior lovingly fitted out by the daughters of Jerusalem. Who are these girls, these daughters of Jerusalem? They worked on this couch. They fitted it out. They made it right. Okay, the daughters of Jerusalem. That's that group that the woman talks to often. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding and on the day of the gladness of heart. Okay. Now, did Solomon write this? you know, it looks like it was written way after Solomon died, and I'll show you why it looks like that. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But listen to how it's a beautiful wedding. You go gaze on King Solomon and with the crowd, and with his mother has crowned him on the day of his wedding. And on the day of the gladness of heart. Now, many people think that maybe he married Abishag, you know, the one that was sleeping with David. They never had any intimacy, but she slept with David to keep David warm when he got cold at night. And, you know, his thyroid had gone down and he had lost a lot because he was in battles. His adrenal glands are probably shot because he was so many hand-to-hand battles. So here is this beautiful tribute to a coming wedding, his day of his wedding. It's a special day. Now you wonder which one was his going to marry. Who was his first marriage? Who was his first wife? He had 700 wives. It doesn't seem like marriage meant very much to him. And yet this looked like so significant. I was at my granddaughter's wedding, and it's very significant, very significant. And there was, "Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and gaze on King Solomon with the crown with which his mother has crowned him." His mother put the crown on him on the day of his wedding and on the day of his gladness of heart. Looks like he's so happy to get married. And I take it that he's going to get married to one woman. He's not going to get married to 700 of them, but he's going to get married to one woman. But he kept taking one woman after another. And after a while, what significance is there for the one woman? What significance? You were replaced. I mean, not replaced. You were added to. You have another woman, another woman, another woman, another woman. You know, now, are those numbers true? One of the famous basketball players said he had sex with 10,000 women. Now, you know, I mean, that can't be right. And maybe, you know, I don't know if he touched them or did whatever he did. But 10,000 women is just, I mean, goodness gracious, think about it. There are 365 days in a year. 10 years would have been 3,600. That's even half the amount of days. You'd have to have sex every day for what, 10,000 women? How many do you have in one day? I mean, it's just, these are numbers that are just astronomical. What's the theological significance of this book? Why is this book in the Bible? Well, it wasn't until the 20th century when they put it in. As I said, they wanted to make it an allegory. It wasn't until the 20th century that people started to understand it as a celebration, as a really... These love songs gained general acceptance. They gained the acceptance that this was truly meant to be a understanding of love, passionate, erotic love between a man and a woman. That's what it looked like. Okay. Now, it was canonized. It finally became part of the Old Testament, and Christians inherited that, what we call Old Testament. It's called the Hebrew Bible. The Jews don't call it Old Testament. They say that's our Bible. And that was the Bible Jesus read. Jesus didn't read what we think of the Old Testament. He read that Bible. Okay, that was his Bible. That was the only scriptures he read. And same way with Timothy. You have known the Holy Scriptures, able to keep you wise unto salvation. Well, yeah, well, what scriptures did Timothy know? He didn't know the New Testament. It wasn't written yet. He knew the Hebrew Bible. It may have been translated, which it was, into Greek, but those are the books he read. So you had these songs that are these songs that are all they're virtually secular, and there's no way that you can take these songs and make them put a divine thing on them. You cannot put a divine thing on them. Okay, they're similar to what it was in the period, maybe even before they were canonized. On the other hand, the physical, sensual, even erotic element in life is this book is telling you that the natural erotic life is not a lower aspect of human beings. I don't know if you've heard people say this. I remember one woman saying this years ago, saying, well, babies are so beautiful and babies are wonderful. They're the gift of God. But why did God choose this way, this ugly, ugly, nasty, dirty, filthy way to have babies? To her, any sexuality, anything like that was nasty. It was dirty. It was filthy, okay? And why did God choose that way? She just couldn't understand, because she didn't think of love or sexual love or erotic love between a man and a woman. She didn't think it was a gift of God, okay? This erotic love does not mean the humans are lesser, rather that it's a gift of God. This book's place in the scriptures frustrates any attempt to denigrate the sensuality aspect of human life. I always tell my clients, there are five things that you are, okay? Number one, you're worthwhile. Number two, you are sexual and sensual. Every child is born sensual and sexual. That's it. Number three, you are significant, because, you know, if you weren't here, people would know something. What happened to so-and-so? I don't think, are they around? You're significant. Number four, you're powerful. People are powerful. They have the power to change their thinking, to change their views, to change their lives. If you want to start changing your life, you're powerful enough to do it. You can make changes in your own life. And number five, you're capable of learning. So you're worthwhile. We know you're worthwhile because our society, at least, you know, we will stop traffic and everything to help you if you were hurt or something, an accident, they'll bring, you know. How about that little girl that fell into a well in West Texas years ago, and they dug a whole section to save her life? She was worthwhile. You were born worthwhile. Sexual and sensual. Significant. Powerful. And capable of learning. When you say capable of learning, it means you could learn anything. If you want to spend enough time with it. If you say, well, I'm not that smart. Well, You go into an airplane and you see all these buttons in the cockpit. You say, oh man, these guys are smart. They know what every one of these buttons are, and they push them here and lights here. How did they learn that? They only learned it one step at a time. They only learned it, you know, they get in here and they learned a few, and then they learned more, and then they added this and they added that, and they keep doing it. They spent hours and hours and hours and hours. And now they learned it, and they know it. And now they've practiced it, you know, in the simulators. And then they finally got in the plane. They had somebody with them, and they learned to take it off. And, you know, all the things that, one, you're capable of learning. You could do that. We all can do that. Now, you may not like it, but you can do that. So the poems of the Song of Solomon express in a very artistic, colorful style, and it also a joyful style, what is expressed in the creation story. What's the creation story? He made them male and female. Male and female created he them. Okay? Male and female, he created them. And it was very good. That's what the very first chapters of Genesis say. He made woman. She will be his helper. She's fitted for him in every way. And she's a helper, just like God is a helper to Israel. She's a helper to this man. And she is also sexual and sensual. Now, in the Song of Songs, I'm going to read chapter 1, beginning in verse 7, all the way through chapter 2, verse 7, because here it appears to be a dialogue between a man and a woman. See if you can see which one is which. Beginning in verse 7, this is chapter 1, verse 7. Tell me, O you whom my soul loves. Wow, my soul, my nephesh, my whole being loves. Where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? So here's a woman. She's saying to her, this man, well, tell me whom my soul, I love you. She loves him. Where do you pasture your flock? Where should I show? And for why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? If you yourself do not know, now listen, he's replying to her. If you yourself do not know, most beautiful among women, this is how they talk. They're diffidently in that Twitter-pated state. Okay, most beautiful among women, go forth on the trail of the flock and pasture your young goats by the tents of the shepherds. To me, my darling, you are like my mare. Now, he's going to, you have to pardon some of these similes. These are similes. You are like, every time you see the word like, that's a simile, right? And you're like something. He says, to me, my darling, you are like my mare among the chariots of Pharaoh. I have a mare. I have a beautiful horse. She's a mare. She's a female horse among the chariots of Pharaoh. And he is now talking to her. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments. Your neck with strings of beads. We will make for you ornaments of gold with beads of silver. And while the king was at his table, she says, my perfume gave forth its fragrance. She had a perfume on, and she knows that he's at the table. She's at the table with him. Her perfume gave forth its fragrance. Then she says, well, let's see who it is. My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, My beloved is to me a pouch of myrrh, which is a spice, smelling good, which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. I was in En-Gedi. They have these Ebox animals still there. I took a picture of one. It was only like 20 feet, 10 to 20 feet away from us in En-Gedi. En-Gedi is where David ran and was hiding in the caves. Solomon was after him. Saul was after him. You remember trying to kill him, and David was hiding in the caves. And then Saul went into the caves to relieve himself, and he went into the very cave that David was in, only David was way back in the cave, and Saul took his robe off, and then David went up and cut a piece of the robe to prove that he could have killed him. And then later on, after Saul has put himself together again, David says, I could have killed you. You were there, you know, you were relieving yourself. I could have done something to you. So she says, my beloved is to me. My beloved, that man is to me like a pouch of myrrh, which lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blossoms in the vineyards of En Gedi. How beautiful you are, my darling. Now, he must be saying this. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves. And then she says, how handsome you are, my beloved. So notice the compliments, the thrill of being in love. How handsome you are, my beloved. And so pleasant indeed. Our couch is luxuriant. The beams of our houses are cedar, our rafters, cypresses. I'm going to go on this, and now this continues on the talk. So chapter 2, verse 1, I am the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among the thorns, so is my darling among the maidens. Like an apple tree among the trees of the forest. In other words, like a lily among the brambles, you know. Like an apple among the trees of the forest, so is my beloved among the young men. Now she's talking about her band too. In his shade, I took great delight and sat down. And his fruit was sweet to my taste. Now, you can make whatever analogy you want, because it's all subject to your own interpretation. He has brought me to his banquet hall, and his banner is over me. The banner over me is love. He sustains me. Sustain me, she says, with raisin cakes. Refresh me with apples, because I am lovesick. Lovesick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. So here is a position from which she wants to be made love to. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. So now here is he's saying this. He's saying this now. So here you have one person saying it, and you see how complementary they are to one another. Now, the word love got perverted many years ago into sexual love, always sexual love. This happened. I'm going to read you a passage of from a book that has. It's from the Countess of Champagne. It was written in May of 1174, of course, in Common Era, AD, way into the Christian era. And this happened because men went away to fight in the Crusades. Many of the nobles and all that, I mean, you know, they went, you've heard of the different ones, the great conquerors and the ones that wanted to go fight the Muslims, who were getting so that they would not take over the Holy Land, and they were going to preserve it. Okay, so now these ladies were left. their husbands. They were these are not the ordinary common woman with who doesn't have a lot of money. These are the women who were married to dukes and duchesses and lived in castles and very high living. And so here's what they did. They got together and they said, you know, they had troubadours. They had, you know, they had to have some entertainment. So they had these wandering troubadours that would come in, they would sing, they would dance, they would do things and entertain the women. And the women started getting desires, many of them desires. They would, these troubadours would play instruments, they would sing love songs, and the women became very, very erotic. And sometimes they seduced the troubadours, and they had what they call love. So you'll listen to how they changed the word. They defined the word. The courts, they called it the courts of love, which defined the word and the traditions of love. This example follows is a code that they a code of love signed by the court of women under the leadership of the Countess of Champagne in 1174 AD. I mean, you know, a common era. Here it is. The code of love, okay, the 12th in the 12th century. Number one, here, this is a code. These are all what they recommend. Marriage is no good excuse against loving. You may be married, but notice loving means sex, you know, romantic sexual encounters. Marriage is no excuse. Don't hold back just because you're married. That's what they've all decided. Whoever cannot conceal a thing, in other words, keep a secret, cannot love. You can't be having sexual if you can't conceal. You're going to tell everybody about it. That's not good. So you have to be, so it has to be secretive and so on. No one can bind himself to two loves at once. You can't be in love with that man and in love with that man, or in love with that woman and in love with that woman. You can't be in love with two at once. That's their rule. Okay. Love must always grow greater or grow less. Listen, in other words, there is no static love. You can't keep it the same way. Love has to grow greater or it has to grow less. Depends on what it is. There is no savor in what a lover takes by force. There's no good thing. Nothing good can come if a lover takes it by force. That has to be, he has to have a willingness of the woman and so on. The male does not love until he has attained a complete manhood. In other words, you can't use kids. You can't use kids. He has a widowhood of 2 years is prescribed to one lover for the in the other case of the other's death. She has to be widowed for 2 years after her husband's death. No one without abundant reason might be deprived of his own love, his or her own love. Okay, you can't be deprived whether. No one can love unless urged thereto by the hope of being loved. You can't go out and love unless you want to be loved. These are all their rules. Love is always exiled from the dwelling by avarice. If you're too greedy, and it will destroy love. It is not decent to love one whom one would be ashamed to marry. You can't make love to a man you'd be ashamed to marry, even if he's a troubadour or something, or the man can't be ashamed to marry the woman. The true love does not desire embraces from any but the co-lover. In other words, the true lover does not desire any embraces but from the co-lover. He doesn't want anybody else, just that one. So in a way, these love things are sort of monogamous in their own way. They have to be faithful to these people. I remember a woman, she and her husband divorced. So, she was still married, but she started getting with this other guy. He was cheating on his wife. So she was his, woman that he cheated with. Now she was already divorced from her husband, but he was cheating on. And so she all of a sudden found he was with another woman. And I said, well, what did you think? I mean, he was cheating on his wife with you. And so she said, well, yeah, but it's okay to cheat on your wife, but you don't cheat on your woman. So she expected him to cheat on his wife, but don't cheat on me. I'm your woman. That's it. You have to stay with me. But he was cheating on her too. So love is love that is known publicly rarely lasts. So all these things have to be kept in secret. They all have to be kept. And notice love that is known publicly. What do they mean by love? That means sexual love, having an affair, having someone. You can't leave it, put it out publicly. As an easy conquest renders love despised, a difficult one makes it desired. So you can't give yourself too easy. You have to be very careful, they're saying. Every lover turns pale in the sight of the co-lover. They expect you to just be so in love that you turn pale. You have to turn pale in the sight of the co-lover. You're just so excited. The lover's heart trembles at the unexpected sight of the co-lover. So they've got all these things. If you've ever been in love, if you've ever fallen in love when you were like puppy love or something like that, you just have all this. You see the name of the girl or the boy or and it just sets you excited. Okay, a new love makes one quit the old. If you give a new love, then you quit the old. It makes you quit the old. So these are all their ideas. These are some of them very silly, very silly. A true lover is, haunted? The true lover is haunted by the co-lover's image unceasingly. In other words, you're really not a true lover. You're not in love unless you have all these ideas of that you're just so entangled with them. So they made love, sex things. All love became sex. And they had all these things. And here's how you know that you're really in love. Here's how you know. That is just ridiculous. And they began to say that love is different. There's no marriage is no excuse for loving. Okay, you have to go ahead even if you want it. You have to do that. Now in the Song of Songs we have a fairly long passage. I'm going to read it here in the time we have. These are the voices of men. Okay, it looks like the voices of men. It's in the Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. You'll see how it's definitely looks like men. How beautiful you are, my darling. How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Now, if you said that to somebody today, your hair is like a flock of goats. You know what the average woman's, I got to get to the beauty shop right now. I got to go right now to the beauty shop because I'm a flock of goats. I don't want my hair to look like a flock of goats. But in that time, a beautiful flock of goats coming down, and he's saying her hair is just lovely. And it could be, by the way, there are black goats, there are white goats, so it could be dark hair too. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Carmel, Mount Gilead. Gilead is that whole section east of Jerusalem, south and east of Jerusalem. Listen, he's describing her completely. Look, your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes. They're just young, they're female sheep. They've just all been shorn, and they look so pretty, and they're white. And so your teeth are just like that, which have come up from their washing. They're all washed up. They're beautiful. All of which bear twins, your teeth. They have teeth on this side, have teeth on this side. They're twins. And not one among them has lost her young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread. She must have had very red lips. And your mouth is lovely. He's looking at her. I mean, he's really studying her. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Up here, he sees this red and glowing. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stories on which are hung thousands of stone, built with rows of stones on which are hung thousands of shields, all around shields of the mighty men. Okay, your neck, okay, built like rows of stones. Your two breasts are like two fawns, you know, beautiful twin fawns, twins of a gazelle which feed among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. I want to find all that sweetness and the perfumes. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. These are love words. These are enticing words. These are seducing words. And there is no blemish in you. I mean, this is a man that's in love. He can't find anything wrong with her. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon, journey down the summit of Amana, from the summit of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. She's like a sister, but she's also his bride. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils. You know, you have oils. Your skin has oils. Fragrance of your oils than all kinds of spices. He loves the scent of her body. Evidently, she didn't eat junk food. She didn't eat ultra-processed food. She must have eaten very nice, good, because the fragrance of your oils is better. It's better than wine. It's better than all the spices. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. So the kind of kisses they gave were very deep. And the fragrance of your garments, and she wore something. You know, we all have a scent. We all have it. I mean, it pours out of your pores and your oil and so on. He says, the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked, a spring sealed up. Your shoots are like an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, henna and nard plants. Nard is like a honeysuckle. It's one of the family of honeysuckles and henna. And then you have nard and saffron, calamus, which is like a palm, and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, and aloes, along with all the finest spices. I mean, he finds her. She is like that. Her body, the smells, the fragrances. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, and streams flowing from Lebanon. So you see, this is a guy who's, he's so in love, and he's telling her all these things about herself, how he sees her. Don't people who are in love want to know how the other person sees them? This is how it is. We'll continue with our exploration of the Song of Songs, the greatest of the songs, in our next sermon. Join me as we end today's service with prayer. Father in heaven, thank you. Thank you that you have made us male and female. Thank you that you have brought people together in love, and that love flourishes, and from that wonderful relationship springs our children, our families, the love that's solid, is even as we grow into grandparents and great-grandparents and everything, it's still a part of that family. We thank you for your mercies every day. We continue to pray for those who are looking to you for help and relief. Please remember Chris Malidi. She's fighting for herself and trying to stay as healthy as she can. Please bless her, Father. Please bless Dawn. Please bless others. Dawn Hooser, all the ones that were fighting cancer, like Sharon Hamrick and all that, all the people that are striving, and comfort the bereaved, like Mary Phelps and others who have lost loved ones. We give these thanks now. We just praise your name and bless you through the name of our great Lord and Savior, Jesus the Christ. Amen.